From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're broadcasting a conversation with the New Yorker staff writer and historian Jelani Cobb. Cobb joined us last night as part of our Realities of Diversity speaker series. It's a partnership with the United Way of Salt Lake City. Cobb's writing deals with the history of racism and how that can help us understand what's happening now. Cobb says we need to know what we're capable of before we can understand the possibilities of the moment. We'll be right back. Her latest short at Radio West Films is about our relationship with our homes. Some people name their houses. They take on personalities as they fill them with their stuff. This is a series we've just started. It's a partnership with the folks at City Home Collective. And we begin with rare books dealer Ken Sanders, who has filled Forest House, that's the name, with the things that remind him of what he loves. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A lot has happened since the summer of 2004. That was when a state senator named Barack Obama got everyone's attention with his speech at the Democratic National Convention. You remember it. Obama said, "This is not a liberal America and a conservative America, not a black America and a white America. There is not a Latino America and an Asian America. There is just the United States of America." And the historian and journalist Jelani Cobb heard it, and I'm sure like the rest of us, he wanted to believe it. He said it's a nice sentiment. It's just not true. In fact, he said it was a damn lie. And later, when Obama became president, Cobb read the New York Times headline that said, "Racial barrier falls in decisive victory." But he knew there was still a racial barrier in this country, and he understood a backlash was coming. But Jelani Cobb gets it. He knows that we have this aspirational ideal about ourselves. That, as he's put it, we Americans want to think of ourselves as better than our history. And hey, he was there in Washington freezing like thousands and thousands of others when President Obama was sworn in. But Cobb is also an historian, and he says that we have to understand the ugly parts of our history as well, to be clear about what we are capable of. Because he says that's the only way for us to understand what he calls the parameters of the possibilities of the moment we're in right now. And what that means is that we're all going to have a really difficult conversation about race before we can really move forward. Please welcome Dr. Jelani Cobb. Welcome.
Okay.
Dr. Cobb, I wanted to... Can we talk about your father first?
Sure.
Willie Lee Cobb, mm-hmm. born in Hazelhurst, Georgia, 1920. Mm-hmm. You write about him in your book. Mm-hmm. And you tell about your father's last day as a child, as you put it, mm-hmm, and this mm-hmm. is The Substance of Hope, your book. Last day as a child, he was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. He agreed to work so his mother wouldn't be evicted. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to begin there because you once asked your father what life was like growing up in the South, and you say in your book that he offered dry words. Mm-hmm. He said, "There's no reason to go on talking about that." But he also told you that you should never be too comfortable. Mm-hmm. What did he mean?
So my father had a very complicated relationship, you know, to, well, one, you know, being black in this country. And I think the things that were implicit within it, having grown up in a one stoplight town in southern Georgia and having witnessed, you know, some horrific things. And things that were both horrific and commonplace, during his childhood. And so he had these kind of competing ideas in his mind. And so I would often say, my father was defined by two sets of experiences. One was, his relationship to the Catholic Church. My father was a Catholic. He converted to Catholicism as a young man. And he very much imbibed the idea of the universality of the church and the kind of familial relationship of God's children and so on. And that was kind of the idealistic version of him. And he was also a black man who grew up in the Deep South during Jim Crow. And that was a far less idealistic version of him. And so it would, depending on literally the day of the week, it would determine which one of those dynamics was more influential in his outlook. And so on Monday, he could say something like, you shouldn't care about anything other than how people treat you. That's the only thing that matters. And then on Wednesday, he'd say, never get too comfortable around white people. It was like, because he'd be reflecting on some of the things that he saw and experienced growing up in the South.
So how did those two conflicting, how did you take those two in? Because it seems like that, on one hand, you don't want to be too comfortable. On the other hand, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you take in both of those ideals in some way?
So initially, I think I thought this was my father's own kind of vexed relationship with the world that he inhabited. And then I came to realize it was really a profoundly American set of questions that he was asking, that he was talking about something that was really, he didn't have the language to maybe explain it in the way that a historian might, someone who's looked at, the texts and the events and, kind of had the luxury of thinking about them and trying to fashion some sort of sensible narrative out of them. But what he knew was that there was this profound contradiction, and that is the case, that this is a country founded upon very high-minded ideals that were underwritten by the most base behaviors of humanity, the enslavement of millions of people, 4 million people by 1860. And so those two things have a symbiotic relationship, that the United States could afford to exist as the oldest constitutional democracy in the world because it had the economic might supplied by an enslaved labor force. And if we don't understand that paradox, then we're ill-equipped to understand all of the things that come after it. And for me, until I understood that paradox, I was ill-equipped to understand my father.
How do you think we talk about race in this country? I know that's an incredibly general question, but you say we often deal with race as this emotional reality or this subject of misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. Explain what you mean. How is it that we go about this? Because we don't do it very well, it seems.
We don't. And interestingly enough, when I guess one of the most useful exercises for me has been in talking to students who are from abroad, because very often they're bewildered by what race is in the United States. And it is a very quirky and idiosyncratic and individual kind of history that shaped, what racial categorization is, here. And just as a quick aside, I was talking to someone about how the overwhelming majority of black people in the United States have white ancestry. And the overwhelming majority of that white ancestry entered our family lineage during slavery. Under circumstances that were euphemistically less than consensual. And so in saying that you identify as like black in this country, it is necessarily a kind of imprecise category to begin with. Yeah. And so I jokingly say that, you know, I have a white great grandparent, if I understand the genealogy correctly. And that means absolutely nothing in my day-to-day existence. Right. And so I kind of always will say, like, if I get pulled over by a police officer, I can't go, oh, this is awkward. You think I'm black. So just to avoid confusion, I've brought with me this portrait of my great-grandmother. And we can just kind of look at her and I'll go on my way. But in that sense, we don't really embrace or confront all of the complexities and all the ugliness that is implicit within any discussion of race in this country. And so on the first level, we don't discuss it. And then on the next level, we discuss it in platitudes.
Yeah.
Where we'll say things that are very agreeable, like we should all get along, or we should all judge each other based upon how we behave or how we interact, and skin color doesn't matter, and race is not a biological concept. We know that it's basically a arbitrary categorization, and so that's the other level of the conversation. The conversation that we avoid is where we talk about the way race functions societally and institutionally and historically. So it's a myth, but we know that mythology, that the myths have power because they have a particular explanatory capacity, or they serve to justify a particular state of affairs. And what race has most often done fairly reliably in this country is collate experiences, the tiers in society. We can look at someone's racial background or their categorization and predict a lot of things about what they're likely to experience in the society. And so even though this is an arbitrary category and it doesn't have a biological reality, we still know that there is one infant mortality rate that is likely to apply to white people, and there's another one that is much higher one that's likely applied to black people. There are expected lifetime earnings that fall in these categorizations. There are likelihood of being incarcerated, every kind of life outcome that we think about is somehow or another collated by this completely random categorization. And we have to be willing to confront that, especially now, I think, because the United States has this both internal sense of wanting to think of itself as a good nation, which is completely understandable.
Yeah.
But we approach that in a almost immature way. Not almost, I'll say in an immature way. Because we think that being good requires that there be a total absence of bad in your character. As opposed to a more reasonable and mature version of this, which is saying that being good is most reasonably measured by the diligence and the tenacity and the sincerity with which we try to do the right thing, knowing that we will fall short. And, you know, a way that I think is probably common to most of what the great world religions would say. And so that's how we, I think, wind up trapped in this non-conversation about race. And I've talked about this in the kind of dynamic in the binary black and white sense, but as we've seen in recent years in American politics, you know, this fractures along lines of language and ethnicity and background and religion and all these other things that we could get into until we get this really bizarre and probably incomprehensible algorithm for who actually has a relationship to democracy.
Do you think you understand what it is exactly that's keeping us from just acknowledging what it is we were capable of, as you've mm-hmm. put it. We were capable of some really ugly stuff mm-hmm. as a country. So what's keeping us from just saying that, acknowledging that? It seems like that seems to be, we have to acknowledge that, it seems you're saying, before we can actually move forward. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true, except that there's a kind of very curious bind, which is that the United States has defined itself as exceptional. And once you define yourself as exceptional, it's like wearing an all-white outfit. Like one speck, and it's, you have to go home and change.
Yeah.
You're done. And you know, the thing that I typically say about being exceptional is that it's like being rich or good looking, which is that it's much better for other people to say that about you than for you to say it about yourself.
Right.
And so I think that we found ourselves in this bind that makes it difficult to really even countenance who we are and who we've been. And one of the things that I've been most concerned about, especially in the last 2 years, is that by having a false, euphemistic version of the past, it lends itself to us not understanding our full capacity for wrong in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we believe that the past is pristine, then we'll go, oh, well, you know, we'll pretty much always be pristine.
Yeah.
Or even more dangerously, if we believe that we faced challenges, but inevitably, just as a kind of automatic element of the American society, that right wins out, then it leads us to be nonchalant in the face of danger or even potentially in the face of atrocity.
I wanted to ask you about something you wrote a few months ago in The New Yorker, and it was about this idea of white space.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's this concept explored by the Yale scholar Elijah Anderson, mm-hmm. and that there are these places in public spaces where black people are basically not expected to be.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets us, of course, to what happened at Starbucks back mm-hmm. in April, when a white employee called the police on two young black men.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that, because you write that this perception of racism is we think of it as mostly a product of monstrous people.
Mm-hmm.
But this was an example of how that's not in fact so, and how mm-hmm. implicit bias mm-hmm. works. Would you talk about that?
Can I give you the backstory on that, which
yeah.
is even more interesting, which is that I know Eli Anderson. He's a scholar who I respect a great deal, and I invited him to talk to my students in the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia. And so he came in and was talking about the ethnography he did of this particular part of Philadelphia. And there was a disconnect. I think for some of the journalists, they thought that he was talking very conceptually and it was at 10,000 feet and, you know, the journalists are supposed to be on the ground. And I think they were kind of wondering what he meant. Although, I mean, I think that people got the general sense that there is such a thing as white space and there's this kind of, what do you call it, cosmopolitan canopy. And the way that space is allotted correlates to socioeconomic dynamics, including race. But I still think that there were people who were kind of like, what is he talking about in this space that he's saying? And then I guess 10 months or so go by, and there is the incident that I think many people are aware of, where the young men walk into Starbucks and the police are called almost the minute that they get there. And that Starbucks was almost in the center of the area that Eli Anderson had been talking about to the students. And so he was saying there are these things that seem maybe ethereal or airy, but they relate to actually what happens in our day-to-day lives. And so the journalistic version of it was, you know, who, what, when, where, and why. I think Eli was really contextualizing the dynamics that really put who, what, when, where, and why into motion. And so Yeah, but that is, you know, one of the realities that we've dealt with in terms of what we've seen now, where this is this kind of expansion. Every day there's a new incident where, you know, someone's the police are called because someone is taking a nap, you know, in their dorm, or the police are called because someone is looking at a property that they're thinking about buying. Or any of these things. I think that I saw a joke on Twitter where someone said that white people call the police like they're calling customer service. I thought that kind of got to the point. But it really does. These things do have a cumulative effect. You know, it's what you see when you look at this person. And there's this other kind of dynamic that we, which I, when the Trayvon Martin story happened and when Ferguson was going on, I wrote about the dynamics of me being a large black man walking into a parking lot at night. Anytime I go into a parking deck, I'm like, please let there be no white women, because I know there's going to be this dynamic. And so if I get into the elevator, or I've been in situations where you're kind of like, this person is afraid of me, and you then have this feeling of almost being soiled because you are a vector of fear that has nothing to do with who you actually are. But then the other unspoken element of it is that the fact that she is fearful makes this situation dangerous for me. And so that I'm fearful of the fact that you are fearful. Because, you know, what happens as a consequence of that, in very many instances, is, you know, call customer service.
You have talked about how we speak in these euphemisms. Like, it's like we're not, we just can't come out and say it. We can't really be direct about what it is that's going on. You say we cloak atrocity in euphemisms. Mm-hmm. I liked how you put it. And then you were talking about the 2016 Republican race for president. And you say that other Republican candidates struggled to find the right language to express white ethnic resentment. They just couldn't come, because they were trying to cloak it in this these euphemisms. But you said Donald Trump managed to speak it fluently. Talk a little bit about that, and I'm wondering if you think that was part of the appeal, as he just said it.
Yeah, I think it was. And so I'll just do a survey here. Does anyone here remember a TV show called All in the Family? Oh, okay, good, good, good. All right. So just put a pin in that. I'm going to come back to it. So I'm from Queens, and the president of the United States is from Queens, and I've talked about this a lot. He is from, I grew up about 3/4 of a mile, if that, maybe a half mile from where he grew up. And he grew up in a place called Jamaica Estates. I grew up in a place called South Jamaica. Those two neighborhoods have exactly the relationship that their names would imply. And so Jamaica Estates is literally on the top of a hill. South Jamaica is literally at the bottom of the hill, and there is a socioeconomic correspondence to the topography there. One of the things that was notable about the Queens that Trump grew up in was that it was overwhelmingly white. It was the second whitest borough of New York City, so much so that, you know, LaGuardia Airport was segregated, and when Jackie Robinson, who was, you know, at the time playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, when Jackie Robinson purchased a home in Queens in the mid-1950s, a cross was burned to let him know that he wasn't wanted there. And, you know, lots of these dynamics that you could talk about in the history of Queens. And this is the Queens of Donald Trump's youth. The Queens of my youth was Jamaica High School, where I played on a baseball team. I was a right fielder. The left fielder was South Asian, Sikh. The center fielder was Latino. Two of the pitchers were Jewish. The catcher was Jamaican. Second baseman was Colombian. And, you know, I say we look like the United Nations taking the field. And Queens, in my youth, was literally what it is now, statistically, the most diverse county in the United States. And so in a comparatively short period of time, that also corresponded with that 1965 liberalization of immigration laws, Queens went from being the second whitest borough in New York City to being the most ethnically diverse borough county in the country, with somewhere around 400 languages spoken in Queens. Wow. And for many people, this was cause for celebration. But for the Archie Bunker, all in the family element of white resentment, it was Bunker mentality. The hordes at the door. Who are these people? What kind of weird food are they cooking? What kind of obscure religion are they practicing? What are they going to do to our neighborhood? They don't share our values, etc. And so while I think Boston had the reputation, people know about Boston's resistance to school busing, that most people don't know that a decade to a decade and a half before that, there were confrontations of equal scope and ferocity in Queens to prevent the schools from being integrated. And so, or for the prevent them from the students bused into other schools. And so the language of anti-immigrant hostility and the language of xenophobia, nativism, that fearfulness that found full flower in the 2016 election, I think it was, to make the comparison, it was like a new language that people were learning because that's where the electorate was, or a portion of the electorate was. But for Donald Trump, this was a language he learned in the 1970s. Mm. He was fluent. And it was very familiar to me as a person from Queens, you know, what those dynamics were.
I wanted to ask about how I think some of us misread the election of Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We were post-racial now. Thank heavens we're past that whole race thing. And
right.
In your book, The Substance of Hope, you say this, and this was published, I think it was 2009, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
2010,
you,
yeah.
2010,
mm-hmm.
Right. Looking back over that race, and you said at the time that we are in a place more asymmetrical than any since the days when some African Americans were still slaves and some were free.
Mm-hmm.
Some live on the street, you write, some live in the White House, and most of us are trying to decipher the meaning of our times.
Mm-hmm.
How did we misread that? What was that's so fascinating that you saw that asymmetry there.
Yeah, I think it was aspirational. And, you know, there is this point where, I mean, Americans want to be done with race. And I think that people have often said, oh, whites just want to be done with race. They don't want to discuss this. I was like, let me tell you, there are a lot of people of color who like way, way more than you want to be done with race. Right? I would much rather be here, you know, talking about, you know, the Mets or something.
Right.
But, you know, this is that quote on the wall, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. I always thought that quote was kind of a setup from Martin Luther King. Because what he didn't tell you was that you had to actually get out and bend it toward justice. It's like someone sells you a really nice car, and it's like it goes really fast. What they don't tell you is that it goes exactly as fast as you can push it. And so there's a lot of work implicit in making that arc bend toward justice. And so for Obama, it looked like this moment. It was like, boom, we're here. Even then, there were these kind of contradictory elements of it, which I felt kind of like I was being a killjoy by pointing out, because, you know, this was going to say, Barack Obama in 2008 won 42% of the white vote.
Yeah.
And on the basis of the electoral behavior of a minority of white voters, 42% of white voters, there were all of these hallelujahs. It was like, okay, we're post-racial, we're done, we're good. And so in short, we were celebrating 42% of white people voting for someone who didn't share their racial background for president of the United States. In short, what 100% of black people had been doing in every presidential election since we'd been allowed to vote. But no one ever came up and said, well, you know, these blacks, we're really post-racial. They got over Roosevelt's skin color, right. Voted for him. They didn't hold JFK, the fact that he was white, against him, you know. We're post-racial now. And so it was already a kind of skewed engagement with that phenomenon. And the other part of it is that we are trapped in basically a kind of boom and bust cycle of democracy, that we have these tremendous leaps forward that in turn engender really vitriolic resentment and an effort to push the tide back. And so we've seen that every time. Emancipation was followed by Reconstruction, and then post-Reconstruction, what people called redemption, which was where we got the rise of sharecropping and lynching and disfranchisement and the felon basically turning prisoners into slaves, recreating the slave economy by using the prison labor force there, the convict lease system. And so all those things emerged as a kind of counterpoint to emancipation. And then we had kind of the Great Migration, which people moved to flee persecution, which is a dynamic that should probably not be lost or is easily understood in this state. So people who fled the South in the persecution there in order to find a better likelihood of personal liberty and freedom elsewhere. But that in turn engendered a kind of anti-migrant violence and the spread of racialized violence throughout the northern and midwestern and in some instances western cities as well. And so civil rights movement engenders the same kind of backlash, you know, afterward. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to look at the election of Barack Obama and say that there's going to likely be a, if not equal and opposite reaction, a very significant and difficult to contain counter reaction to this. And I think that we saw that.
I wonder, one of the things that you've talked about is you hear people kind of mystified about why it would be that certain Republicans might be voting against their interests. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you've talked about not so long ago was that you're not so sure they are voting against their interests.
Right.
Would you talk about that?
I think that I gave an analogy about this.
Because the presumption is that they're voting against their economic
interests. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. The presumption is that if you vote for someone who is going to enact policies that materially harm you, then you're voting against your interests. But it's also presumptuous in that it assumes that you know what other people consider to be their interests. And no one operates purely based upon their financial interests. If someone came up to you and said, I'll give you $200 for your kid, you'd be like, depending on how your kid behaved that day, you'd more than likely turn them down. But the other analogy I think that I gave was that there was a kind of sacrifice that people were willing to make in order to shore up the world as they wanted it to be.
Like a tithing.
Like a tithing, right. So if you were to say, if you were to take a person who gave their last $5 to the church, to the non-believer, that would be a completely irrational act. They would say, you don't have money to buy food. You don't know how you're going to get, you know, transportation. That was irrational. But to a believer, that person might say, this was purchasing a sense of my fidelity to my faith, that this was giving to something that is bigger than I am. And if I am willing to part with and grapple with the financial sacrifice, there's a bigger benefit to me in the all these other ways. If we understood white supremacy in this society as functioning in some ways like a faith, and someone said that in order to maintain the order that we have right now, we may want you to tithe your health care. We may want you to tithe policies that would be beneficial to the funding of your public schools. Or we may want you to tithe whatever it is that people consider to be in your monetary and financial interests. But on the other side of it, you get this sense of fidelity to your faith and to your community. Then all of a sudden, the actions of people who appeared to be going against their own interests seem to make much more sense. This is depressing.
Does it have to be? Does it have to be?
No, I don't think so. And I'm glad you asked that, because I don't think so. A student accused me of being pessimistic. And what I said was this. I said, I don't believe that progress is impossible. I simply believe that progress is difficult, and that we have to be very clear that the reason that we have had persistent problems is because they're not easily resolved. But it is a difference between recognizing that cancer is a wily, complicated, just complex biological phenomenon that would seem to outwit us at every turn. That's one kind of statement. It's a completely different statement to say that we can't cure cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm simply trying to say that what we've been diagnosed with in this society is a very wily and complex problem. And at the same time, if I believed that it was impossible to have change, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. And the people who we revere, everyone who we've ever thought was heroic in any regard, we hold them in that regard because of what they did in times of immense adversity. And I think that's what it is. Like, you get the ambivalent blessing of understanding why your heroes were considered heroic.
You know, when you've talked about, so it's complex, right? And it seems like, okay, so it's, I wondered, it's maybe the, it's biological. We all have this capacity for tribalism. We all have this natural suspicion of mm-hmm. of the outsider. But I wonder, is that true? Do you think that's true? There was an email you got once, and I'm not sure how long ago. I've heard you talk about it, where someone said to you, "What if it were the reverse?" And what they were thinking was, Jelani, the way they saw it, mm-hmm. they thought you saw it in the same way as a mirror image.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like that's the case.
So I got an email. It was a really fascinating email, and it was informative in ways that I don't think the author intended to be. I'll take my information where I can get it. I'd written something about immigration and about the what I thought were kind of xenophobic tendencies in modern American politics. And this person wrote to me and said that I should just be honest and admit that if this society had, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of undocumented white immigrants running around, I'd be just as alarmed as he is about there being tens of thousands or millions of undocumented people from Latin American countries. And I was like, oh, no, I wouldn't. I was like, because I think that you think that this is a kind of like choosing up sides in, you know, a junior high school basketball game or something. And that we're all each kind of doing a demographic tally and looking over at each other and saying, how many people you got? And I was like, no, I'm really more interested in inclusion and equality for everyone who's here. I'm not really invested in saying that. You know, so in many people will remember in the 80s and 90s, there were lots of people from Ireland who had come to the United States and overstayed visas or people who were in the country illegally. And I thought that then that we should grapple with the complexities of what is happening in Ireland and the ways in which we can reasonably approach integrating people into our communities. And so it's not that. It's the kind of more expansive version of wanting us to recognize our common humanity. But it was notable to me that one of the things I guess that people do is that maybe they see their own worst motives in the actions of others. And I thought, I was like, oh, this is one of the reasons that while we're at this impasse, because we're talking two completely different languages.
There's a moment of history that you've written about when Louis Armstrong canceled his performance tour of the Soviet Union. This was 1957, upset over what was happening in Little Rock, Arkansas at the time. Of course, the governor was trying to keep these nine African-American kids from going to class. And you were writing about this, I think, in the context of the athletes in the NFL taking a knee as an act of protest. And I wanted to ask you about this. You say there's this expectation that we have of entertainers, and I'm guessing sports players, and that they are, as you've put it, obliged to adopt a pose of ceaseless gratitude, that ungrateful, as you put it, is the new uppity. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that this idea of how people are perceiving these men taking a knee, I think, is interesting. I wanted to know what you thought about it.
Yeah, I think the thing that that most struck me about that conversation was the insistence that this was an act of ingratitude. You know, as if, but it's also kind of contradictory because on the one hand, with our adoration of free markets in the United States, we have the NFL, which is, 2,000 people? I forget what the exact number of it is. But a highly, highly elite labor force that has trained from childhood to cultivate a highly, highly specific set of skills that generate an astounding amount of money. In any other context, we would say that they should get whatever the market commands. That this is talent, and this is how free markets are supposed to work. They're supposed to reward talent in this way. But given that we're talking about African-American men, we look at them and say that you're being given something. And that was the language that was used around this so frequently. And the thing that I thought was another contradiction that was almost amusing to me was that they were saying that basically if you were rich, you were supposed to just be happy and not complain about anything. But this country just elected a rich guy who does nothing but complain about things. It was like that was central to his appeal. And so there were all these things that were happening like at once, and it reminded me of Louis Armstrong because, you know, Armstrong is this kind of complicated figure. You know, he's this genial, avuncular, you know, musical genius, but the persona that he adopts is very non-threatening, very accessible to white people. And he did things like continued to play segregated music halls at a point where many other African-American musicians were refusing to do so. And so I say all that to say that in many quarters of black life, Louis Armstrong was thought of as an Uncle Tom. And then Little Rock happens, and a teenage journalist questions him about what he thinks. And he called the governor several iterations of the MF word. And I was actually impressed, like adjectival versions of it. And so people were shocked that that kind of contempt and anger could exist at the same time as that outwardly genial, completely pacifistic character that he played on stage. And so I think that people had that same sort of idea about the football players, that they were supposed to just be happy, that they were not supposed to talk about the fact that they come from a demographic that is disproportionately likely to be killed by police, unarmed, and all the other kinds of discriminatory dynamics that happen in their lives. And so that was what they wanted. But no, what they got was that moment when Louis Armstrong let the mask slip, and he actually was saying, "This is, oh, you think the guy with the horn, you think that's who I actually am? Like, no, I'm going to introduce you to the guy from New Orleans. And like, that's who I really am when I'm not on stage."
Jelani Cobb is with us. He's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, where he writes about race, politics, and injustice. We are at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. This is the first event in our Reality of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. And you're listening to Radio West.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
So, I felt weird about writing this question because we're so cloaked in these euphemisms. Is Donald Trump a racist?
The last time someone asked me that question, I said, for journalists, you have to have a very high bar. And we have to be about empirically understanding things and taking all dynamics into account and, you know, being as meticulous and thorough as we can in weighing all the possible explanations to any particular question. But having done that, I'm like, hell yes, absolutely, he's a racist. It's not really that hard.
I say it in this context because you've written this. You say the media has tended to frame the idea of whether Donald Trump is a racist as more of a question than a statement. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to get your sense of that we're dancing around something.
Yeah, because if you go to like the headlines, there are like an abundance of headlines saying, "Is Donald Trump a racist?" And despite the fact that he was charged with discriminatory housing practices in the 1970s. He called for the death penalty for five African-American men in the 1980s who were accused of a rape, which it turned out that they were innocent of and never recanted about that. He purportedly said he did not want black women winning the pageants that he owned. He referred to Africa and Haiti as the alleged S-hole countries. He has said that a justice, a judge, could not preside over his case of, you know, Trump University fairly because of his Mexican lineage, ancestry. It was just kind of gone through this kind of greatest hits catalog, you know, of those things. And so we continue to avoid it. And I remember one of the things saying, pointing out that he dated a black woman, as if that meant that he couldn't be racist. It's like, and, you know, one of my good friends pointed out, it was like, that is almost like saying that men who date women can't be sexist. And so it was kind of like, wait, what? Where are we? But it's like the bar is on the floor at this point. And so the bar can go no lower in terms of anything that's exculpatory for him. Like the least, you know, he petted a black dog. There it is. He's not racist. But the ultimate implication of that is that we're avoiding the idea that 62 million Americans voted for someone who is a racist and what that means. Like the things that we as a society, I say we as a society, like in the societal sense, the things that have been done in our name, it's much easier to criticize the exemplar of those things or to criticize the leader. Much more difficult for us to criticize ourselves for asking people to do that on our behalf, which is essentially what happened in 2016.
It's that bar that I want to talk about. You say it's on the floor at this point. You write about what you describe in a piece for The New Yorker as this elastic tolerance of the otherwise intolerable. Mm-hmm. That's where we've gotten to. And you wrote a piece about the Omarosa book. Mm-hmm. And the question of whether there's this tape of the president saying the N-word.
Yeah.
And you say that whether or not, in fact, there is one is, you say, inconsequential. But the fact that it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. that's the thing of a great... of consequence. I wanted right. to ask you about that.
Yeah, and by the way, I left out birtherism. How could I leave that one out in the greatest hits collection? But the fact of it is that, you know, if a tape, this is what would happen. If a tape of Donald Trump using that word emerged, the first kind of wave of shock would be people going, oh, I'm horrified that he said this. Which would rapidly give way to people pointing out that Barack Obama has allegedly used that word. And then Tucker Carlson would say, rappers use this word all the time. And then it'd be like a supercut of rappers all saying the word. And then it would dovetail into a conversation about why can't white people say the word? And then it'd be kind of 1,000 think pieces on it. And then before you know it, we would have forgotten that Donald Trump ever said it. It would have no effect. And so whether he said it or not is really inconsequential. But the fact that it doesn't matter is what actually really matters. Because it means that we have not... It means that anything can be rationalized. And that's one of the things I find most scary about the moment that we're in. People know my politics. As David Remnick said, you know, one's politics should be hidden in plain sight. People know that I'm more or less on the left side of the equation for most things politically. But one of the things I did find shocking to me, that even as a person who I thought was fairly skeptical, was that the tolerance of indecency. I did not believe that Republicans would vote for a person who ridiculed a reporter who has a disability. I did not believe that. And a whole host of things. I did not believe that that given what we know about Vladimir Putin, that what happened in Helsinki could be basically swept away. And that has happened. Honestly, it's probably worth saying in this moment in particular, I did not believe that someone could ridicule John McCain's 5.5 years as a prisoner of war and still be widely lauded in Republican circles, if for no other reason than the party's affiliation with the military as the party it supports, the armed forces. And I don't want to offend anyone who's Republican here, but I'm just telling you things that surprised me. And so we have societally found a way to reconcile ourselves to things that would be unconscionable in any other circumstance. And that's how we wind up with autocratic, that's how autocracy begins. And so I think that's what worries me the most.
How do you envision an ideal conversation? How does it play out? What does it look like? Do we gather in town halls and hash this out? Mm-hmm. Acknowledge our past, strip away the euphemisms, say what we've done, hug it out? I mean, what do we do? Uh-huh. How are you thinking about what this conversation, how do we do this, I mm-hmm. guess?
So, I mean, I think it's interesting that Germany has, you know, this model. Well, let me just kind of back up for a second. One is that I think that there's some particularities about the United States and its history, you know, in being in the South and kind of looking at the monuments to Confederates and so on. It has like the weird inconsistency that usually is the side that wins the war that gets the monuments. But in this country, if you were a completely uninformed observer, you would go around this country and say in 1865, the Confederates must have kicked the hell out of the Union Army. Based on what we laud and what we honor. And the reason that we're able to laud and honor the Confederacy is that their actions and their willingness to die in defense of the right to own, buy, sell, rape, beat, breed, and exploit other human beings, they're willing to die for that. That has been completely detached from what we know of the Confederacy. And so if you can do that, you can then paint yourself as a victim. And if you are the victim, you have the kind of moral mantle of never needing to atone for what's happened. It's not uncommon, you know, in World War II, when the Soviet Union, Stalin's forces killed 20,000 Poles and buried them in mass graves in the Katyn Forest, and then simply said it never happened. Or the genocide in Armenia, which the Turks to this day simply say never happened. Or the rape of Nanking in 1939 in China, which for decades the Japanese said 500,000 people killed in a span of 3 or 4 months. The Japanese simply said it never happened. And if you can wriggle out from under the moral responsibility for committing an atrocity, it puts you in this position where you can go out, you can proceed in the world as if it never happened, and therefore be inclined to commit it again. Germany, I think, is exceptional because Germany's path back into the community of nations was contingent upon it recognizing what had happened in the Holocaust. And, you know, South Africa, because of what happened there in the context of the Cold War, and the idea that there needed to be truth and reconciliation, that we have to actually, if we can't offer you recompense for this, we can at least offer you the truth. And that you can do with that, make of that what you will. I think that those become examples that if we get past the idea of thinking of ourselves as exceptional and therefore perfect, we can actually say we should have things like what Bryan Stevenson did in Montgomery, where he created the monument to people who died as victims of lynching. It's possible to exist in a society and never know that that happened. And so if we are willing to confront our history in these ways, I think that it's possible to actually move forward. Or it's like the Freudian sense of a nightmare, where the nightmare repeats until the underlying conflict is resolved. And I think that's where we are at the present.
I don't want to keep bringing us down. But I do wonder, because you asked this question in The New Yorker not so long ago, just how fragile is the union, our republic, and a country that's long been considered the world's most stable democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And you, it's interesting, you interviewed this national security expert at Foreign Policy, a man by the name of Keith Mines. And Mines, in your article you write, Mines concluded the United States faces a 60% chance of civil war over the next 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
How fragile are we, do you figure?
Yeah, I think that, you know, first off, that was like sobering. But here's the optimistic part of it. I'll get to the optimistic part at the end, right?
Good. Okay, good.
At the end of the Civil War, we'll have a great society. No. it's not what I mean. So one of the things I think that is pressing, I think that I'm not alone in thinking that we have a very serious crisis in that there's been foreign intervention in an American election. And nothing being done about it. And we have a head of state who doesn't believe that it has happened. And so that is it's a tremendously dangerous situation. As a society, if you don't have sovereignty, then you don't have a society. And so those kinds of cybersecurity issues, which are, I guess, the province usually of a very particular portion of like American politics and American society have now become much more broad concerns. And so those are the things that scare me. On the other side of it, the way that I wound up in that conversation was that we were talking about efforts to reform the Electoral College, of which there are many. And, you know, the one I'm most knowledgeable of is an effort to create a compact where states will award their popular votes to the winner, excuse me, award their electoral votes to the winner of the popular election. And so right now I think there are 11 states that have signed on for it, and the compact will kick into effect once there are 270, the equivalent of 270 electoral votes. That's important for a number of reasons. The most practical being is much more difficult to skew an election in which you're literally just counting up millions of people rather than the kind of cantilevered electoral college way that we have, that we do it now. The other is that in order to do that, you actually have to have a broad swath of people of different backgrounds in the society who are willing to work together for a common goal. Like, shocking. Imagine that. And then, you know, kind of finally, going back to, you know, Madison, in his writings in the Federalist Papers, you know, he talks really explicitly about the ways that human nature can lead democracy astray. And, you know, the people who founded this country just completely trashed them at the beginning for the tolerance of slavery. But at the other side of it, like the people who founded this country had really profound insights into human nature. And so what we're seeing is not outside of the conceptualization of what could happen in a democracy. Is just a question of whether there is, I think, the democratic will and good faith to actually respond to it in a way that ensures democracy can continue.
And do you think there is?
Guardedly optimistic.
Yeah.
But I think I have to be guardedly optimistic to get out of the bed in the morning.
Yeah. Would you tell, finally, Dr. Cobb, the story I've heard you talk about after 9/11, on a plane? I think it's lovely, and do you mind telling it?
Yeah, I don't. It's one of my favorite stories, actually. Not long after September 11th, I was on an airplane and it was going from Atlanta to New York. And, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember what it was like flying after 9/11, it was a very nerve-wracking experience. I'm seated in an aisle seat about two-thirds of the way back on the plane. And there's a gentleman who gets on the plane who is tall, kind of olive brown complexioned. He's wearing a kufi on his head and a tunic and white kind of baggy pants. And he has a long beard. And so he reads as Muslim to everyone. And he comes walking down the aisle. And I could almost see the tension ratcheting up as he kind of walked closer. And as fate would have it, he sat down across the aisle from me, one row back. I look over at him. And then I look over again. And I said, "Excuse me, where are you from?" And he indignantly shot back, "Where are you from?" Which is, you know, an appropriate response under the circumstances. And I said, "I'm from Queens." And he said, "Okay." And now everybody is paying attention, like everybody around is paying attention. And I said, "I'm asking because I think you're from Queens too. And if you are who I think you are, we were in the same breakdance crew in high school." It's like all the white people exhaled. He's a breakdancer. He's not going to kill us. He was like, "Will," he called me my first name. And I was like, "Shake." And he was like, "Yeah," we stood up and hugged and, you know, we're talking and all these things. We're like happy to see each other. And what I took away from that experience was that if we just had a tabula rasa, you know, for Muslim, all these kinds of things, foreigner, threat, terrorist, we're going to die, hostile, hates America, all these other kinds of things, we can just project those onto that blank screen as he walked down the aisle. But what I saw was the best breakdancer I knew in high school and someone whose home I had spent my formative hours in and someone whose table I had eaten at. And it goes back to this idea of kind of growing up in this community where diversity was a given. There were so many of us from so many different places that we were thrown together and we had to interact. And what came out of that was an actual sense of what we wouldn't have called it at the time, but what we actually were developing there was a democratic sensibility. It was the ability to see your own humanity in someone else that is fundamental to the existence of democracy. And so whenever I tell that story, I always make a point of saying that it was the fact that I had grown up around him and the fact that he knew me. Although, like, comically, his name was Sheikh, Sheikh. And I thought that was his breakdancing name, Sheikh, Shake. And I thought that was, like, the best breakdancing name ever because we would literally shake. And then I told him that and he laughed. I was like, "Yeah, I didn't." It took me years before I realized. I was like, "Oh, that actually wasn't his name." But yeah, that's what I think is important.
Jelena Cobb, he's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. Dr. Cobb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two more conversations coming up in our Reality of Diversity speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. For details about that, visit our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction today from Brian Albers and Lewis Downey. Our thanks to Bill Krim, to Geraldine Stowe, to Ashley Rajan, and the United Way team. Thanks also to Chris Monty, Sam Mills, and of course the S.J. Quinney College of Law. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.